failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Iraq was involved in 9/11. Saddam has reconstituted his nuclear program. Extraordinary rendition requires torture, hostage taking, wiretaps, extortion, eternal war. Number two, banana Republicans rule. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. I'm glad you could be with us. Our guest will be Eric Sterling. He's president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. And we'll hear from Cliff Thornton, who just announced his candidacy for the governorship of the state of Connecticut. And we'll hear the black perspective on the drug war from Mr. Phil Jackson. And by the way, that little musical intro editorial was in fact my opinion and pure satire. Now we go to our guest.
We're proud to have with us on the Century of Lies program today one of our more regular guests on the Drug Truth Network. He's the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Washington, D.C. I'm proud to welcome Eric Sterling. Hello, sir.
Hello, how are you? Good to talk to you again, Dean.
It's good to talk with you, sir. For those who may not be familiar with the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, please tell us about your organization.
We're a nonprofit based in Silver Spring, Maryland, that advocates for drug policy reform and other criminal justice reforms.
Well, Eric, you've probably heard me make the statement that the war of terror, because certainly there's terror on both sides of this thing, but the war of terror is basically the war on drugs with afterburners. Do you see some parallels there?
Yes, there certainly are parallels. Perhaps what's most striking right now is to see how what we're doing in the anti-terror effort is counterproductive. It marked parallel to the counterproductive efforts in fighting the drug problem. In trying to fight the terror problem, instead of identifying what motivates terrorists and what can be done to isolate them politically, we've given them more political power, we've given them economic power, and therefore we're not helping our situation, we're making it worse.
Now, Eric, I know that the machinations of the drug war make it possible for law enforcement officers to basically skirt the Constitution to perform illegal searches and seizures. And isn't it true that President Bush, through his wiretaps and other searches, has circumvented the Constitution in much the same way?
Oh, let's put it this way. Most police officers are formally trained in the limits of the Constitution, the requirements of due process, the requirements of obtaining a warrant, the requirement that suspects be advised of their rights before they're interrogated. But many police officers then learn on the street that if they dispense with those requirements, they can obtain convictions. And they learn as well that if they lie in court about what they actually did, this will be believed, and that evidence that they've obtained illegally will be introduced, and they'll be able to get convictions. What's a little bit different in the situation right now is that President Bush has insisted that what he has done is lawful, even though it's in the face of the statutes, face of the Constitution. It's not lawful. The Congress created a procedure for monitoring communications of foreign nationals and of course, Americans. And the president has said, I don't have to follow those procedures because the authorization of force resolution to go into Iraq covers that. It's such a broad misreading of the law, and it's different than the kind of lie that a police officer might tell in trying to preserve an illegal search in a prosecution. Because here, the president is being much more brazen. He's not denying that he engaged in this activity that's contrary to the statutes and that carries criminal penalties. He's saying, I had an exception. He's saying Congress gave me an exception. And then he's also saying, aside from Congress's exception, I have inherent power in the Constitution as Commander-in-Chief to disregard the law when I assert that it's a national security matter. That is intellectually perhaps the same, that is, breaking the law is justified by the higher end of fighting bad guys, but it's different by being brazen, not saying I deny that I've done this activity or we did it this way. He's saying, this is exactly what I did. I did engage in this action that's forbidden by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, but I'm claiming this bogus authority, and it's very, very dangerous. It's not merely a skirting of the Constitution. I think it is a flouting of the whole idea of the Constitution, of checks and balances, the idea of the Constitution that the president must obey the law that the Congress writes. It flouts the idea of the Constitution that the president is not a dictator.
You mentioned inherent powers that he seems to claim. If that were true, we could reach back through time, and all the other prior presidents did not use or claim that power. Republicans are saying of late that the Democrats have a pre-9/11 mentality, the Republicans a post-9/11 mentality. What's your thoughts on that?
To talk about pre-9/11 mentality is to make a political statement. The Congress did not amend the Constitution after 9/11. The framework in which our country has been governed for 200 years wasn't set aside by terrorists. I mean, to say that the country was changed on 9/11 is to say the terrorists changed the country. That strikes me as either a dishonest kind of statement or giving terrorists more power than they deserve. It would be as though saying, well, the Japanese changed America in 1941 when they attacked Pearl Harbor. They didn't change America. They simply attacked us. And we did not abandon our Constitution and our form of government to defend itself. So that what you're hearing is not any kind of statement of fact. You're hearing a public relations tested line that says we must behave as though the law changed by terrorists, that the Constitution was changed by terrorists. And, you know, I hope to God that no one thinks that terrorists get to change our Constitution.
Well, you know, there's other, I'll call them scandals, on the horizon as well here. We have the Mr. Abramoff with his lobbyists and the funding of many congressmen, and I see a type of rope-a-dope underway, a chance for them to escape scrutiny, a chance to allow time to take focus off of this problem and to pretty much leave it the same. What's your thoughts on that?
Abramoff, as a lobbyist, was not unique. He went further than many, but there are others who go almost as far in obtaining favors from members of Congress. I remember going on a congressional fact-finding mission to South America in 1983, and at the end of the mission, we were in Jamaica staying at a beach resort, and a dinner was paid for by some bank or finance company, I no longer remember which, that had no particular interest in the drug problem, but was very interested in having, you know, access to the members of Congress who are on that fact-finding mission. The buying of access has existed for a long time, and it is a serious problem. And Abramoff, of course, crossed the line in defrauding his clients. happened. It looks like, you know, he bribed Congressman Bob Ney, the chairman of the House Administration Committee, to get him to make statements and take actions that helped some of his clients. With DeLay, we have a situation where DeLay set up his own little charity, and it turns out that the charity received $1 million from a London, England law firm, and that those funds were actually being laundered by oil industry people from Russia who wanted DeLay to change his position on International Monetary Fund policy. Here's a case where the majority leader of the House of Representatives, in effect, is being bribed by a Russian industry. That's a scandal, and DeLay has not yet been prosecuted for that. Those are the level at which the pursuit of money and power distorts public policy making.
I know if we reach back pre-9/11, there was a major scandal afoot then with the corporate funding. WorldCom, Enron come to mind. And many of the congressmen, I think, were implicated in taking bribes from these officials in exchange for laws which benefited those corporations. And yet, with 9/11, again, the focus went away from that. This seems to be a cycle, you know, given some focus, and then it's taken away, and new problems crop up and take away the headlines and that focus. Your thoughts, sir?
The late Eugene McCarthy actually had a sort of famous aphorism. He said that the news media are sort of like the birds that you see sitting on a telephone wire. One bird suddenly flies off, and suddenly all the birds fly off. And, of course, his point was that the news media travel in packs in terms of how they pursue a story. And the challenge of the news is that it's supposed to be new. Enron is yesterday. WorldCom is yesterday. What makes it news? What makes that scandal news is something different, which is now in the realm of analysis. It's the realm of understanding what went on. And that requires more than just a sort of titillation of previously unrevealed connections. I don't know that Enron or WorldCom is charged with bribing members of Congress. You know, Ken Lay was a fundraiser for the president and a friend of the president when he was governor of Texas. I wouldn't call their relationship one of bribery, but certainly what is important is that we not forget how it manipulated energy markets, how it manipulated the market for energy in California at tremendous price to Californians, causing blackouts in California and costing California taxpayers billions of dollars. These are cycles that, in fact, go far back, you know, and they are seen in, you know, the Harding administration. They're seen in the Grant administration. They're seen in other countries and in other governments. The framers of our Constitution knew that there was the danger that power would corrupt, and that the reason that power was dispersed within our constitutional scheme between the federal government and the states, between the Congress, the executive, and the courts, was to prevent corruption from being unchallenged and unchecked. It is our duty to continue to expose it and to fight it, and it would be naive to think that it can ever be eliminated. It is important that the news media be encouraged to focus on these stories and not simply things such as Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction in the Super Bowl. Those are scandals in that they divert the attention of the people from important issues.
I recall that President Eisenhower, as he was leaving office, warned us to be on the lookout for the military-industrial complex, and I think if he'd had a better crystal ball, he might have warned us about the prison-industrial complex as well. But reaching back before 9/11, I think we were spending some $400 billion a year for military, for the security of our nation. And yet, for want of a bit of discussion between agencies, the Twin Towers were brought down. We're up to now, I don't know, I'm guessing $800 billion that we spend on this war and on security. And yet, I don't feel more secure. Your thoughts, sir?
I guess the great challenge that we're facing in the United States is that the public needs to be more insistent to members of Congress and senators that they do their job, which is to oversee what's done and to solve national problems. Both political parties are engaged in a fairly crass, nevertheless important, fight for power. The Alito nomination is an example of that. Alito is a perfectly qualified candidate for the U.S. Supreme Court, picked by President Bush. To oppose him simply because we don't like his politics is not, I think, a good enough reason to oppose him. To oppose him on that ground would be to legitimize a Republican attack upon a perfectly qualified Democratic nominee of a Democratic president. And as long as the two parties are engaged simply in fighting to score points against each other, they're not looking for the common ground that is necessary to solve very important national problems. And the failure to work together, the failure of our legislatures to focus on the problems, but rather to focus on scandals or on rhetoric, allows problems to remain unsolved. And that has been the historic hallmark of failing societies and failing governments. The American people have enormous power that they fail to exercise because they don't participate in the political process. They don't do enough of throwing out incumbents. When people pay attention, there can be real results. Sometimes it means you have to abandon both the Democratic and the Republican Party and support, you know, independents like Kevin Zeese, who is running for the United States Senate, trying to get the nomination of the Libertarian Party and the Green Party in Maryland to succeed Senator Paul Sarbanes. I think that it is important to send wake-up messages to the two parties that they do not have a lock on the loyalty of the voters.
Well, you know, it's I think certainly just so out of whack that, you know, a black drug user on the street corner with a $5 rock of crack will be sent to prison, be sent to jail, be tried immediately, or certainly within a few months. And yet people like Ken Lay and his ilk that basically swindled billions from the American people are still carrying around $100 million and walking the streets. Your thoughts on that disparity?
You have identified, you know, one of the classic injustices of our justice system, and the remedy, again, it depends upon the public outrage and the public shaping of the debate. In the whole drug area, the federal government is wasting its resources. 70% of federal drug offenders are low-level offenders, like lookouts and bodyguards and mules, according to the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and only 7% are high-level traffickers. Overwhelmingly, these are also people of color. They're black, they're Hispanic, they're poor, and the high-level offenders get to cut deals and inform on the people below them. The drug warriors should be asked to support focused enforcement that is going to produce results. They have an obligation to do that. 20 years ago, in 1986, Congress passed very harsh mandatory sentences for crack cocaine dealers at 5 grams or 50 grams. A 5-gram trafficker gets a mandatory 5 years up to 40 years. A 50-gram trafficker of crack gets a mandatory 10 years up to life imprisonment. But those prosecutions do nothing to stop the flow of cocaine to our streets and do nothing to stop the crack problem. Today, there are as many crack users in America as there were 20 years ago. It simply hasn't been effective. And so we need to call upon Congress to ask the Justice Department and the DEA be effective. Use the tax money effectively. If only members of Congress asked for effectiveness, we would begin to see a redirection of our resources away from low-level offenders toward high-level offenders.
We've been speaking with Mr. Eric Sterling, the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Washington, D.C. Eric, any closing thoughts, sir?
The government doesn't run on automatic pilot. It demands control from the citizenry. It demands our participation. If you cannot simply criticize Washington or politicians or Republicans or Democrats if you're not involved, if you're not writing to them, writing letters to the editor, demonstrating in the streets, using the political rights that are built into the Constitution that are part of the corrective. And it is, I would just sort of add that it's worth thinking about what impeachment means and when it's called for, because impeachment was seen by the framers as an important power of the people to control the executive and solve the failure of the executive. The problem of the failure of the executive to act and solve problems.
I want to thank Eric Sterling for being our guest. You are listening to Century of Lies on the Drug Truth Network and Pacifica Radio. If you'd like to learn more about Eric Sterling and the work he does at the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, I urge you to visit their website, which is at cjpf.org, Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. Eric mentioned that Kevin Zeese is running for senator in Massachusetts, and I wanted to make note that another drug reformer, Loretta Nall, is running for governor in the state of Alabama, and just this week, another drug reformer has stepped into the fray.
My name is Cliff Thornton, and I'm running for governor of Connecticut on the Green Party ticket. What I'm planning to do is to make drug policy a central issue here in Connecticut. As we all know, the politicians don't talk about it.
Now, Cliff, let's talk about some of the reasons for the need to examine it. What are some of the things? In what ways does the drug war impact our society?
Well, when you look at Connecticut, Connecticut has a population of 3.4 million people. Black and Latino males make up less than 6% of that population. But they account for almost 68% of the 20 or so thousand prisoners in Connecticut, with 70% of them being there for drug-related charges. This begs the question, is race and class a factor in the enforcement of our drug laws? And if not, how do we prove that to skeptics? The other thing I'm looking at is universal health care for Connecticut residents. These are just a couple of things we're going to be talking about, but what I'm going to really do is play off what the candidates running for office will say, because it is almost impossible to elude the drug war, because the drug war is 2 degrees from everything in society.
Cliff, the economic impact that, if in no other way, the money that we use chasing down crack dealers on the corner could be better spent on education.
I totally agree with you, Dean. Here in Connecticut, for cannabis alone, we spend $70 million in the arrest, prosecution, and imprisonment of cannabis users only. So if you look at all of the other drugs, we're talking about $140 million that could possibly be saved. And make no mistake, if elected, I am going to push the state legislature to look at this and really consider changing these laws. The thing that we have to understand, alcohol prohibition started to fall when the governor of New York at that time frame said he was no longer going to enforce the laws in and around alcohol prohibition. And that is the same thing that I'm going to try to do.
Don't go playing the blame game. There's no time for delay. Don't go playing the blame game. Look away. Look away.
If you're a long-term listener, you're familiar with Mr. Phil Jackson, who does the Black Perspectives for us here at the Drug Truth Network, and I'm glad to say that once again we found the ways and means to have him join us on a weekly basis.
And now another Black Perspective on the drug war. To make any sense at all of the war on drugs, you need to understand its racist origins. If it had been launched to improve public health and safety, it would have been focused on alcohol and tobacco, and medical marijuana would be legal. Instead, the drug war is focused on the drugs preferred by blacks and Mexicans to allow them to be discriminated against on a basis other than skin color. So long as the drug war is predominantly a problem for black and brown people, it is unlikely to change. But what if it was expanded to include opium? Not opium, OPM, other people's money. Now, to white-collar criminals, other people's money is just like a drug. They crave it like crack when it calls to them from savings and loans, trust funds, and fat public coffers. But what would happen if the police applied the same principles and practices in pursuit of the people who plunder our pocketbooks, pension funds, and paychecks as to those who puff placidly on pot? What if white men driving high-end late-model cars were racially profiled until driving while white became a criminal offense? What if corporate executives had their condos raided on anonymous tips and their 10-year-old daughters strip-searched because those people often hide money in their children's accounts? Instead of urine testing, what if they were subjected to random forensic audits, zero tolerance, mandatory minimum sentences, asset forfeiture, and permanent exclusion from all government contracts for themselves and their families in perpetuity? If OPM was added to the list of controlled substances, the war on drugs would be halted in a week. Oh well. Dream on. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
My name is Angel Raich. I'm a mother of two teenage children, and I fought all the way to the Supreme Court for the right to use the medicine that saved my life. I've been permanently disabled for 10 years. The medicine that gave me my life back and gave my kids their mom back was cannabis, also known as medical marijuana. To learn more about medical marijuana, contact Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or on the web at mpp.org.
It's the old black market that we like so well. The stinky black market that no one can smell. The old black market is our road to hell. We like it, we love it, 'cause we're in its spell.
Please visit our website, endprohibition.org, and you can listen to hundreds of our shows at drugtruth.net. There is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, in fact, no reason for this drug war to continue. We've been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Prohibido istak evilesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Guthrie.